Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program that is produced for those of you who have come to realize that the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, even counterproductive. I'm Yetta. Our number, if you'd like to join us anytime over the next couple of hours, is toll-free, 877-300-7645. There's an interesting story that was sent my way early this morning that reads in a very fluid way. I'm not sure that it reads in a very thoughtful way, but it certainly reads in as a storyteller would convey complex information. And so I'm going to share it with you in the manner it was written. It's going to take a unique voyage into a place that we very seldom go in the first hour. It begins on a Sunday afternoon at a bustling cafe less than a mile from Stanford University's Palo Alto campus and more than 5,000 miles from his home. An assistant professor from MIT is telling me about science. Very advanced science. His name is Jeremy England. And at 33, he's already being called the next Charles Darwin. Say what? In town to give a lecture to the Harvard grad and Rhodes Scholar, speaks quickly, his voice rising a few pitches in tone, his long-fingered hands making sudden jerks when he's excited. He's skinny with a long face and scraggly beard, what you might expect from a theoretical physicist. But then there's the street-style Adidas on his feet and the kippah atop his head. And the fact that this scientist also talks a lot about God. The 101 version of his big idea is this. Under the right conditions, a random group of atoms will self-organize, unbidden, to more effectively use energy. Over time, and with just the right amount of, say, sunlight, a cluster of atoms could come remarkably close to what we call life. In fact, here's a thought. Some things we consider inanimate actually may already be alive. It all depends on how we define life, something England's work might prompt us to reconsider. People think of the origin of life as being a rare process, says Vijay Pandey, a Stanford chemistry professor. Jeremy's proposal makes life a consequence of physical laws, not something random. Might I say, in this regard, that Yahweh is created a construct whereby the universe is all comprised of the same well-organized substance. It's energy. Now, energy can coalesce into matter. And there's a set of physical laws that Yahweh conceived that enable energy to, in a diminished form, to come together in what appears, although it is not, to be solid, as matter as opposed to energy, even though matter is energy, just a reduced form of energy, which is what E equals MC squared means. And so if energy and matter are the same thing, but that matter is a governed, a controlled, and diminished form of energy, then might we also expect that life, whereby the very dynamic of life, which in animals is a soul, but certainly not for plants, that life is also a form of energy and matter that is organized, that there is a structure, that there is a set of conditions that were conceived by the Creator. And indeed, we find this set of instructions that guide energy and matter, the interaction between energy and matter, to be alive, to function for us. And that structure, that code, that framework, we call DNA. So why should we be surprised that there is so little difference between that which is energy and that which is matter and that which is alive? It was conceived at the same time by the same being for the same purpose, all at the same time, all in the same way. It's an expression of Him. So I'm not the least bit surprised that this is where his research is going. England's idea may sound strange, even incredible. No, it doesn't. It doesn't sound strange. It doesn't sound the least bit incredible. But it's drawn the attention of an impressive posse of high-level academics. After all, while Darwinism may explain, and they just say evolution, why don't we say microevolution, and the complex world we live in today, no, it really doesn't. It explains microevolution, and that's all it ever attempted to explain. It doesn't account for the onset of intelligent beings. It doesn't even account for the onset of life. In fact, if you were to extrapolate from Einstein's theory, you end up with the standard theory of macroevolution, which is that life, however impossible, let's say improbable, emerged over long periods of time and then evolved. When the evolution of life to more complex beings is astonishingly unlikely because energy and information are lost, not gained. And the genome degrades, it doesn't get enhanced over time. But beyond that, what the Cambridge explosion proved, and what we know conclusively now, is that that theory was wrong. You know, all forms of life as we know them today emerged over the blink of an eye from cosmic time in less than 5 million years amongst the 14 or so billion years the universe has been in existence. And so there is no explanation for this kind of thing in macroevolution. But if you're looking for answers, I think if you look at a combination of two things, the similarity between, in fact, the identical nature of energy and matter, and that how matter is simply a diminished and slower form, if you will, an organized form of energy. Not that energy is in the least bit disorganized. It's just that there are certain rules for organizing energy so that it can be diminished as matter. And there are rules for the conduct of life, for the conception of life, for the processes of life, and those rules are articulated in DNA, which is a language. So this makes perfect sense. This goes on to say that England's insistence on probing the step that preceded all of our current assumptions about life is what makes him stand out, says Carl Funk, a Cornell physics professor who has been following England's work closely. Every 30 years or so, we experience these gigantic steps forward, Frank says. We're due for one, and this might be it. And all from a modern Orthodox Jew with fancy sneakers. Now, before England became a religious man, and this says he prays three times a day, he was a scientist. Now, you all know that God hates religion, and that he is more disappointed with Judaism than he is with Christianity or Islam. That the religion that he speaks the most aggressively against is Judaism. So, we would not be in support of England becoming a religious man, or England praying a religious prayer three times a day, or England wearing the yarmulke on top of his head. But there are some insights here that England provides that are, in fact, enlightening. He became a scientist first. From the time he could read, he devoured books on subjects like philosophy and the study of our natural world. By 9, he was plowing his way through Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. He couldn't comprehend it, but he tried really hard, his father said. His father's an economics professor at the University of New Hampshire. And yes, Dad, as an economics professor, and Mom, as a public school teacher, took their children to museums and to visit Harvard's campus just a few hours from their small seacoast town. But the elder England contends that his son's upbringing doesn't explain his intellectual curiosity. I disagree. You know, well, I think you can overcome the lack of a stimulating upbringing intellectually. I was very seldom taken to museums, but I was given something that I think was even more valuable by my parents. And that was trips around the world. From the time I was like 16 years old to the time I was 20 years old, we spent every summer traveling the world. I was taken to some 150 or more countries by my parents. What an education. The world was my museum. And so profoundly important in expanding my horizons perspective. And in the case of our children, well, they did not, well, they have traveled the world, and I've taken them around the world. What we emphasized was the world brought to us in museums and books, and we spent an enormous amount of time studying them. And their intellectual curiosity is beyond most young people their age. So I think you can instill it. I think you can promote it. I think you can prosper it, promote it. I think that is what we ought to recognize, as opposed to saying that we had nothing to do with it. Now, when we return, there is something about the Torah that's going to come up next you'll find interesting. Of England's longtime relationship with asking big questions, he speaks of how a childhood friend reminded him of a time that he was young and yet reflected, you know, if the dinosaurs can go extinct, so can we. In England, who was 3 then, says, yeah, that was drove him to think. For his part, England says that it wasn't until he hit about 7 that he felt a sense of anxiety over not knowing enough. You know, I think that drives a lot of us. You know, when we speak with Kirk in the second hour, I often hear him being anxious about not knowing. He was anxious about the conflicts from regarding his Christian religious upbringing. Was anxious about those, was anxious about not knowing. I am too. I've always been that way. I've always been anxious that I just don't know enough, that I'd like to know more. I'd like to understand things better. I only become quiet when knowledge gives way to understanding by making connections. And once you transition from not knowing enough to knowing enough to form rational, thoughtful conclusions which lead to understanding, then the anxiety dissipates. I think you also see that in Kirk's tone and discussions when we're talking. So England is similar to many of us in this regard. That anxiety would compel him through an almost comical list of academic bastions. Harvard, I don't know why this is comical. Harvard, Oxford, Stanford, and Princeton. Now teaching at MIT. I mean, the only thing he's missing from that resume of superlative institutions would be Caltech and Cambridge, I guess, would be. You know, if you got Oxford and Cambridge, you've got Harvard and Princeton, you have Stanford, MIT, so all you need now is Cambridge and and Caltech. Still, God wasn't a player for England's life during much of his childhood. While his mom is Jewish. His dad was raised Lutheran, but never felt strongly about his Protestant ties. There wasn't a lot of talk about religion when he was growing up. And the Englands would share a festive meal for Passover, and they would light candles for Hanukkah. Hanukkah is rabbinic. It is not scriptural. It is not from the Torah. Passover, of course, is. And, of course, the festive meal for Passover, that's a good thing. It's a good start, but you better not stop there. The family didn't keep a book named after the sun goddess Biblia in the home. His mother, England said, was born in Poland in 1947 to a family ravaged by the Holocaust. Much of her extended family, including her grandparents, were killed by the Nazis. And in the wake of such destruction, England says Judaism brought up negative and painful feelings for her, so she distanced herself. That speaks volumes to all of us. That which is painful, we distance ourselves from. Yahweh does the same. It seems ironic, then, that anti-Semitism would eventually push England to the faith he says his mother spurned. While studying at Oxford in the early 2000s, he faced his first anti-Israel sentiment from classmates. It's interesting. Oxford. Anti-Semite. An anti-Semite institution. You know, it's always been that way in England. Always. I mean, it, as far back as recorded time the UK, we find the UK anti-Semitic. They played a huge and negative role in the establishment of Israel and in the conditions that led to the Holocaust. You don't want to be in England when Yahweh returns. He said this got him in an expected fashion, reading books and picking people's brains to figure out where he stood on the issue of anti-Semitism. And in 2005, he visited Israel for the first time, where he fell in love with the Torah. The Torah provided an opportunity for intellectual engagement that he says was like anything he ever experienced in terms of both subtlety and its grandeur of scope. Here is a man that's being acclaimed as one of the most brilliant of our age. He fell in love studying the Torah because it provided an opportunity for intellectual engagement unlike anything he'd ever experienced, both in terms of subtlety and grandeur of scope. I concur. So does Dode. So do all of you. We'll be back in a moment. During his postdoc research on embryonic development, he kept coming back to the question, what qualifies something as alive or not? He later superimposed an analytical rigor to that question, publishing an equation in 2013 about how much energy is required for self-replication to take place. For England, that investigation was only beginning. I couldn't stop thinking about it, he says, his normally deep voice rising until eventually cracking. It was so frustrating. Over the next year, he worked on a second paper, which is under peer review now. This one took his past findings and used them to explain theoretically how, under certain physical conditions, life could emerge from non-life. In the most basic terms, Darwinism and the idea of natural selection tells us that well-adapted organisms evolve in order to survive and better reproduce in their environment. England doesn't dispute that, and I don't either, as far as it goes for microevolution. But he argues that it's too vague. For example, and this is something that few people think about, blue whales and phytoplankton thrive in the exact same conditions, the ocean. Same conditions in the ocean. Same place in the ocean. And they couldn't be any more different. And so, if natural selection is designed to have animals evolve so that they can replicate most effectively and survive most effectively, then we would have to conclude that the plankton is more evolved than the whale. Why? Because there are far more plankton, and they survive in far greater numbers than do whales. But yet, we would look at the whale as being a much more complex and obviously more intelligent life form. Now, he didn't say that. Now, none of that's in the article here. And it just says, you know, plankton and whales, blue whales, live in exactly the same environment. And so Darwinism doesn't explain that. In fact, Darwinism would say exactly the opposite, that the more evolved animal would be vastly better able, through natural selection, to survive and to reproduce. And yet the most well-adapted organism is actually the plankton, which thrives in the same conditions, in exactly the same place. So both of these do so by very different means, and that's because while they're both made of the same basic building block, strings of DNA are arranged differently in each organism. And there you go. DNA is the program, not natural selection, not evolution. The program is not evolution. It's simply a consequence, a derivative. The program isn't Darwinism. It's simply an observation. The program is DNA, a language. Just like the physical laws of our universe are languages. It's a concept that can be conveyed by language. Now, England's simulation of an opera singer who holds a crystal glass and sings at a certain pitch, instead of shattering, England predicts that over time the atoms will rearrange themselves to better absorb the energy the singer's voice projects, essentially protecting the glass's existence. So how is a glass distinct, say, from the plankton-type organism that rearranges itself over several generations? Does that make the glass a living organism? You know, one of the things we talked about on this program was the fact that the slit test that's done in college and in high school physics classes that shows that light, when it is observed, manifests itself differently than when it's not observed. And so the observation of the light causes it to do things that are different. And so we say, so if the light can detect observation, then there is something that is let's not call it consciousness, but there is something about the light that enables it to manifest one of the most important animal characteristics. You know, animals with a soul can observe and react to what they see, what they witness, what they experience. Well, light can do the same thing, and light's a form of energy. It's not even energy equals matter, but times the speed of light squared. But the fact is, we should not be surprised by this. This is exactly as you would expect it to be. You would expect matter to have an organized method of response, just as does light energy. And if light energy can observe and respond, why shouldn't matter? It's made of the exact same stuff. And life appears to be this integration of matter and energy, all orchestrated under the auspices of DNA, a language. This is exactly as I would suspect it would be. I think traveling down this path, he will find success. These are pretty things to ponder, according to this writer. I don't know, pretty wouldn't be the word I would use, but nonetheless, he says, unfortunately, England's work hasn't yet provided any answers, leaving the professor in a kind of speculative state as he doggedly tries to remember it all. He hasn't put all of his cards on the table yet, Frank says. He'll need to make some more testable projections. So it remains to be seen whether England will land where he will land in the end. Other scientists have made similar claims about energy dissipation in the context of non-equilibrium thermodynamics, but none has found a definitive means for applying the science to the origins of life. But what they're saying here is that we witness in energy what he is suggesting we should witness in matter regarding its transition into life. Now, I'm not as smart as Roy, who calls in and comments from down under in Aussie land. It's interesting that this article was published by Aussie. I don't know if there's a connection between the two. I suspect there is. But nonetheless, this is exactly how I see it. It's how I think the Torah describes it. I think that there's a reason that this scientist focused on this the nature and the relationship between matter and life, and in my case, I would say you should be broader and look at the relationship between energy, matter, and life, that this scientist has such a love for the Torah, that it's in the Torah that he finds the greatest mental stimulation, whether it be in the subtlety of the details, the shadings, if you will, or the profound scope of it all. These things are all related. So what does God have to do with all of this? The article continues. In his quest for answers, England, of course, finds himself at the center of a classic struggle between science and spirituality. There should be no struggle. He says, while Christianity and Darwinism are genuinely opposed, yes, Christianity and Darwinism are opposed, Judaism doesn't take issue with the science of life. It's because Judaism is at least to a reasonable extent based on the Torah. The Torah explains evolution. It endorses evolution. It discusses evolution. Evolution, macroevolution, is, while it odds with reality, microevolution is wholly in sync with the Torah. The Torah describes microevolution, each species after its kind. So, of course, Judaism wouldn't take exception of it. Christianity, however, has repudiated the Torah prophets and Psalms, and therefore the Christian religion is opposed to what the Torah prophets and Psalms teaches. Judaism is not. Now, Judaism isn't right, but at least on this issue, they aren't wrong. For his part, England believes that science can give us explanations and predictions, but it can never tell us what we should do with that information. That's where he says the teachings come in. Indeed, the man, and he's talking about the Torah's teaching, indeed, the man who's one-upping Darwin has spent the last 10 years painstakingly combing through the Torah. He has spent the last 10 years observing, closely examining, and carefully considering the Torah, the teaching, interpreting it word by word, much the way he ponders the meaning of life. These things are related. They have led him to these conclusions. It's the conclusions that I have adopted based upon studying the Torah. His conclusion, common translations are lacking. Boy, isn't that the truth. I wouldn't use to say that our English translations are lacking. I would say that our English translations are almost worthless. They're horribly errant. Now, he says, take the term creation. Now, The word for creation is bara in Hebrew, and as we examine it with as our program develops in the second hour, we'll consider what the term bara means. But he says, take the term creation. England suggests we understand it not from the literal making of the earth, but rather as giving the earth a name. Now that would be of, and since every one of Yahweh's names has a meaning, you could say rather giving the earth meaning based upon the name. All throughout the Torah, he says, and the prophets are examples of terms that that could be interpreted differently from what we have come to accept as the standard. Wow. So he has seen the Torah as the most fundamental, the most subtle, the most vast, the most engaging and mentally stimulating document in the universe. More stimulating, more thought-provoking, more endearing than even is the canvas of science. And it's the place that he turns to for teaching. A book that he realized has been horribly translated, but is best understood when closely observed. We'll be back. We have Glenn on the line. Glenn, while we were in the commercial break, I looked up plankton. Because, you know, plankton, I've always wondered, you know, you've seen pictures of plankton, and the largest form of plankton, it kind of looks like a really tiny shrimp. But plankton come in every different style and shape imaginable. And there are plankton that are like little shrimp. There's plankton that are unicellular and still animal. And there are plankton that are described as more like algae and therefore more like plant. So really extraordinarily complex and diverse life form.
Yes.
Anyway, you probably didn't call about plankton.
But by far the best plankton is the cartoon arch nemesis of Mr. Krabs in the SpongeBob cartoon. He's looks like a cucumber with feet and an antenna and a single eye, and he sings "You Will Obey" because he's a megalomaniac who wants to rule the world.
Well, I have never seen him in that form. I'm now familiar with him because I Googled when I saw your name. I said, you know, I probably said something incorrect because I figured, you know, plankton was probably I thought it was a animal life form. And I said, maybe it's just plant. And come to find out it's both animal and plant. I saw that little critter because that little critter is more popular in the imageries associated with plankton than are actual pictures of plankton.
Oh, absolutely. Let's see, he's a megalomaniac and wants to rule the world. And so, yeah, he's sort of that's just amazing. I'm a nurse who works with kids, so, you know.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay, good.
So now I'm going to take off my tinfoil hat and put on my contrarian hat for a minute pick on your academic ever just so slightly. And that is, in spite of his genius intellect and his effusive praise of the Torah and his many hours of careful consideration of it, he has nonetheless, apparently, thus far, failed to come to the conclusion failed to understand the importance of the feasts and especially the roles of Matzah and Passover. Maybe Passover, but you even alluded to it earlier. Apparently, he's not yet grasped the significance of Matzah. And, Oops.
Oh, yeah, oops. And the fact that at this point he is still in the clutches of, and he chose rabbinic Judaism, he's first of all, he's a bit of a hypocrite in this regard, because in rabbinic Judaism, one of the things that they tell you is that you ought not be doing what we're doing, which is observing the Torah, because they view the Torah as rabbinic law, and you're told to observe it, which would be the Talmud and the Mishnah, because of the fact that that we mere mortals are incapable of understanding the actual Torah, and it must be interpreted for us, which is the purpose of the oral law. And so the fact that he is studying and looking at the words that comprise the actual Torah, Yonah was teaching in Hebrew, and view it as teaching, he's already at odds with the Judaism.
Right.
But yes,
right. And the prophet's teacher, especially not...
Yeah, I think what he has here, Glenn, is that he is coming to know, and that knowledge is opening up his mind, but he has not yet come to understand.
Right, and the prophets too, because you're especially not supposed to study, you know, Daniel 9 and 10.
Yes.
We're in
complete agreement. What I wanted to share is that here is an extremely bright man who is studying the very origins of life, who is considered now to be amongst the most profound thinkers of our day, finds the one book that he can fall in love with, the book that is the most intellectually stimulating, the book that has both the subtleties of nuance as well as the grand scope, the book that he studies for perspective, the book that he realizes is horribly translated, and when properly translated, is profound and accurate.
Right. So it seems that he has his microscope tuned in a little too close, and he needs to throttle back a few, to turn the objectives back to a less magnified,
Can I play with your metaphor here? I think that's only true to an extent. I think that the more we focus on the jots and tittles, the little strokes that comprise the Torah, the more closely examined, the better. But, you know, most microscopes, at least during my day, they had one eyepiece, not two. And if you have one eye looking at the jots and tittles and the other for perspective on how everything fits together in the grand scope, then I think you have the best of all approaches and perspective for understanding.
I'm not saying one to the exclusion of the other.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, no, you're everything you said, I agree with.